Chapter 1. All secrets are truths yet to be told. Charles Luxhold, PhD, The God Within Us. Ping checked for a signal on her phone. It still read, "No network." Even after she had already tried switching in and out of airplane mode and restarting the device, other employees stared at their phones and engaged in similar rituals to summon the bars back to the tops of their screens. Eventually, each one settled into a silent wait, hoping the outage would resolve itself. Ping was confident that the issue lay with the carrier. She needed the new Red Shuttle schedule. The Red Shuttle ran from the current factory in Zhengzhou to the new factory at Luzhuang Village, some 10 kilometers to the south. The posted schedules were obviously out of date. The mist in the air was giving her a chill. She had been sitting for well over an hour, and the bench's metal bars had sucked a little too much heat from her body. Ping stood and began to pace to keep warm. Initially, she confined her pacing to the front of the bench in case she wanted to sit back down. As boredom won out, Ping began walking laps around the shuttle stop. Still, there were no buses. On what would be her final lap, Ping looked south. "It's not too far to walk. Not more than a couple of hours." Ping broke free of the shuttle stop's orbit, not knowing how long her journey would be. Her only concern was getting to Lanhua 5, the new plant, and getting settled into her new apartment. 20 minutes into her walk, Ping could see her old place just a few blocks to her left, but there was no reason to visit. Everyone had moved out days ago. She was among the last managers at the plant. Today had been the final day of Lanhua 4's shutdown. By the time the movers arrived to pick up her belongings, employee housing was a ghost town. The only people she had seen in days were maintenance crews renovating other units for the next wave of tenants. Ping missed her bike. The movers had taken that with everything else. This morning, Lanhua had paid for a Didi so she could get to work. Now she regretted not taking her bike. Lanhua 5 would be a long walk in work shoes, but her new housing assignment was there. She had no choice. One good thing, though, was that there was no need to hurry. Lanhua 5 would be open whatever time she arrived. There were as many workers at midnight as there were at midday. Even human resources was 24/7. Ping hadn't bothered to write down directions or her new address. It was all stored in her company profile. She assumed the shuttles would take her there. Lanhua always had packets waiting on the shuttle, and under typical circumstances, the information would have been accessible through her phone. Busy with other aspects of the shutdown and her move, Ping had failed to anticipate the possibility of a device outage. Now she mused over the irony of her predicament. Ping managed a group of some of the best cellular communication engineers in northern China. With the tools at their disposal, they would have known what happened before she asked and told her exactly when she would have her service restored. Outside Lanhua's gates, Ping was as much at the mercy of sunspots and power outages as any other customer. Her walk would take her through Zhanghehu Shangyang Park. Ping had lived in Zhengzhou for almost a decade, but had only been to the park once before. A sprawling, lush maze of gardens and man-made water features created a paradise in the southern district of Zhengzhou. Water diversion from the north fed one of the world's most amazing urban green spaces. As beautiful as they were, the water features were a challenging maze to navigate without a phone or map. Ping checked again, still no signal. By now, she had passed dozens of people, all engaged with their devices and obviously online, confirming suspicions that her carrier was the problem. Lost in corridors of late-blooming lilies and roses, it was easy to forget she was on a mission. 10 years had passed since COVID-19 made its mark on the world. Yet masks still created a parade of unwelcoming faces, making it impossible to differentiate between acquaintance and stranger. The Chinese were accustomed to avoiding eye contact, though, and masks just made the custom more off-putting. In a city of 10 million people, you could walk forever without recognizing a familiar face. Despite the recent surge, Ping refused to go back to masking outside of work. She hated the claustrophobic sensation and found the smell of her own breath bothersome. As she waded through the crowd, Ping's natural beauty invited occasional eye smiles amidst a tide of disapproval. She made the effort to meet the gaze of mask wearers. After an hour of this silent challenge, one pair of oncoming eyes behaved quite differently. A man stopped and pulled a familiar face from behind his mask. "Ping?" Ping immediately recognized the voice. It belonged to her best programmer. "Lin, what are you doing here?" Candidly, Lin answered, "I'm supposed to meet a girl." He was always trying to meet girls. "So far, I haven't had much luck with Seoul. Not sure she's coming." Seoul was a popular dating app in the area. Changing subjects, Lin said, "I'm surprised you're not home already." "I would be if the shuttles had been running. We just wrapped up the relocation today. Final shutdown of Lanhua 4, Ping explained. Lin clarified, "I meant home with your parents, like the rest of us." Ping didn't follow and explained, "There was no time for me to go to Ankang. I knew I would be needed at Luzhuang as production geared up. Figured I'd see you there." Lin chuckled awkwardly. "That's what we all thought." Seeing that Ping hadn't grasped the situation, Lin's frustration grew, but his desire not to embarrass her pushed him to be more direct. "You do know what happened, right? The layoffs?" He paused, but Ping showed no sign of recognition. "We've all been laid off. There were no transfers, not a single one. Rumors are flying that there's no new factory. I even heard that Santos Corp acquired Lanhua." Ping was immediately dismissive, even in her body language, as she shook off his words. "These Santos rumors. 3 kids from Boston are buying China," Ping said confidently, looking Lin directly in the eye. "The factory is real. I'm headed there now." Lin continued, "Well, they loaded us onto shuttles. Managers gave us confidentiality agreements before giving us our severance and a ticket home." Lin pointed east. "My parents live there, so I told them to forget their confidentiality agreement and just got off here." Lin pointed at his feet. Ping argued, "Oh, that doesn't make sense. Where are you working now?" Lin spoke deliberately. "I'm not working, Ping. There are no jobs. These layoffs started months ago. They hid that from all of us. There were 20,000 layoffs in the first wave. Those were the lucky ones. They got the good jobs. I stayed on until wave 5. By then, there was nothing left. There is literally no work. Not in tech, not in waste removal. Thankfully, my parents still have their jobs. I'm with them until I figure something out." Ping had never seen or heard of someone with Lin's skills, going a day without work. She wasn't sure whether something else had happened that he just wasn't sharing with her. That seemed far more likely than a corporate conspiracy. Lin liked to drink, and he made some of the women he worked with quite uncomfortable. She wondered whether he was trying to hide an embarrassing incident with his ridiculous cover story that she wasn't falling for. "I'm sorry for the run of bad luck, Lin. I'll see if there is anything for you when I get to Lanhua 5. Ping was a senior manager. She would keep his story in mind. If Lin had been laid off for no reason, she'd find a way to bring him back. Despite his personal life, Lin was the best software guy she knew. Lin didn't seem overly confident in her offer, but he trusted Ping. I'll send you my new number. Company phone just stopped working the other day. He went on to explain. Then it blanked, and I lost all my contacts. Ping went to update Lin's contact. More tech issues. A blanked-out contacts icon appeared on her screen. That's odd. Mine's not working either. Lin grew frustrated at her naivety and urged, "Not odd, Ping. Lanois. You're ridiculous. My contact list isn't worth hacking." As the words left her lips, Ping felt her stomach involuntarily tighten. Too many coincidences. Too close together. Maybe she had been laid off. She should have waited for the shuttle. Now she needed to get to the new factory as fast as possible for reassurance. "Lin, I have to go," already resuming her trek. Lin called after her. "Don't worry, Ping. I'll find you. I can find anyone." White noise played from the nightstand. The windows were programmed to let the sunlight filter in. The increasing brightness brought Charles Luxold out of his deep early morning slumber, ending what would be the last night of sleep in his life. The night before, Charles toyed with the idea of taking a sleep aid or a nightcap. He ultimately chose to lie awake, contemplating his mortality. As the hours passed, his mind meandered down a dusty road of memories, eventually leading him into the arms of sleep. The only dream that lingered until morning was about the sea. Charles was on a catamaran, bigger than any boat they had inside the dome. There was a storm, something that couldn't happen inside the dome. Nick was at the helm. Waves broke over both bows. Then a large wave took Eve. 1 second she was there, then gone, swept overboard. Eve disappeared in the froth of the tempest. Charles woke in a cold sweat. He lay there trying to make sense of the dream. Charles was the one who was leaving. Nick and Eve would stay behind. There were no waves in the Atlantean Sea. It was a dome-covered reservoir where nothing bigger than paddle boat traversed its calm waters. Eve had said something as she was swept away. Charles couldn't remember what it was. She looked so sad. Nick refused to go back to get her. If he had been the one swept over, or if it had been the two of them, it would have made more sense. Charles was about to embark on a one-way trip. In a few hours, Charles Luxold would shed his mortal coil, the price of immortality. His closet was filled with clothes he would never wear again. Charles hadn't planned out what would happen to all his possessions. He wasn't a pack rat, but there were still items of value. They should be passed on to the people he cared about. In a moment of lighthearted reflection, Charles wondered, what does one wear to their death? Eve had brought him an outfit weeks ago, but now it seemed over the top. It was a gold brocade tunic paired with 200-year-old ceremonial clogs. Charles would certainly make an exit as he ascended the stairs. Like the two people who had gone before him, Charles's death would be a ceremony. Today's immortalization marked the culmination of a week of festivities and ceremonies honoring one of the great minds and men of the 21st century. For someone who had always survived rather than sought the spotlight, it was a trial. The event featured recorded speeches from long-gone public figures praising Charles and his work. Dead men lauding achievements for which Charles refused to claim credit. He would take a bath, then a shower, then shave, brush his teeth, and join his family for a private breakfast. He had no children and no wife. His father had died 25 years ago. He would never join him in the Elysium. So many departed. Now Charles was leaving a great life earlier than he had hoped. At 60, Charles had reached a tipping point. Even with nootropics to stabilize neuronal aging, his brain was withering. Babylon's top neurologist had argued that the ideal age for upload was 50. Charles held out a decade longer. He had hoped to uncover a different path, spending much of that time with the intent of straddling the two worlds. Charles aspired to know his immortal self before he died. Prior to this ceremonial week, preparing for the immortalization had taken most of the last year. Charles spent 12 months enduring all manner of tests in anticipation of his transition. Test after test, interview after interview, scan after scan, all for validation of a future self. Would he die? When his ascension came in a year's time, would it be he who rolled back the stone? The giants promised rebirth. Charles would emerge a better version of himself. How would he know? If this immortalized self believed he was Charles Anand Luxhold, born December 4th, 2003, would his discarded self feel the same? Cynthia, the first giant, insisted she was still Cynthia. She and Charles had long talks while he prepared for his transition. She assured him the process was painless and exhilarating, both an honor and an opportunity. Having known her for almost 30 years, Charles felt Cynthia retained much of the person he knew before, but he had concerns. He feared he might be prematurely entering oblivion. As if she read his mind, a call from Cynthia ended his brief pause. He hesitated, then sent the call to voicemail. He wanted a minute longer with his thoughts. Predictably, a text followed that read, "Pick up, Chuck. I know you want to." Fully aware she would continue to text until he answered, Charles accepted her calm. "Nervous?" "A little," he reflected. "I'm resigned at this point." Prone to banter when anxious, Charles mused, "Hopefully, it's not a sham." As if she knew exactly what would calm him the most, Cynthia played along. "Yes, Chuck, I've done all this as a ruse. I've spent the last decade in Wesden with the new Amish. We stand ready to welcome you into Christ's light."
"That's kind of the way I figured it would go. These last 10 years, I knew you couldn't go through with it. Jack, too. Clever how he's nowhere to be found."
"You can't take a good joke too far." She paused as if noting something off camera. "Eve's arrived. I guess it is time for breakfast. Catch you later." And the transmission ended.
"No bath for me, I guess," he remarked as he slipped on the robe, slid into the clogs, before stepping out of his bedroom for the last time in his life. Charles took his seat at the head of the table and looked around. He grinned. "I always imagined it would be a last supper, not a brunch." There were nervous laughs. His mother had obviously been crying, but she smiled through it. Over the past few days, Charles had caught glimpses of what he believed to be his mother praying. His closest friend and mentor, Nick Santos, was at the other end of the table. Nick was unusually reserved. Nick rose and walked over to Charles. As Charles stood to meet him, they embraced. Nick quietly said, "Big day, my friend. There is no Judas Iscariot here, just dear friends celebrating a moment with a great human. No death, just the birth of a giant, an immortal destined for great things."
"One small step," Charles quoted, making the mood a little lighter. "Did Sin reach out?" Nick asked.
"Sure did. Nothing from Jack, but I wouldn't expect him to. Not his style."
"Definitely not his style," Nick confirmed. "He lives in his projects." Interrupting his own train of thought, Nick pointed to the buffet. "I brought bagels. Eve's making French toast, and there's bacon. Life's simple pleasures."
"You're the richest man on earth, and it's a Denny's breakfast." I was the richest man on earth. That's when there was money. Nick paused, thinking. Also, those bagels are spectacular. David baked them for you himself. Every good as black sheep bagels back in Cambridge. Nick looked Charles in the eye. I walked halfway around the dome for those. Charles took a bite and said, No cream cheese. Speaking with his mouth full, he added, It's cold. You should have jogged. Nick, understanding Charles every bit as well as his immortal sibling, shot back, Well, you could have met me there. Charles smiled and grumbled. David's talented, but it's not black sheep bagels. He considered the textures and flavors in his mouth before mumbling, Still pretty good. Cynthia had told Charles she didn't miss food. He wondered whether it would be the same for him. It was hard to imagine that one could spend an eternity without bacon. Charles reached onto the serving plate and put a thick, perfectly cooked slice of applewood smoked bacon in his mouth. The salty, smoky sensations confirmed what he always knew. The Jews were wrong about bacon. Are you ready for the crowds? Nick asked sarcastically. Pretty sure there won't be any protesters. The nearest religion group was almost 30 miles from where they sat. Let's have a look at our friends to the north. Over the center of the table, a holographic view of zealots 30 miles to the northwest came into view. Thousands of new Amish stood as their pastor addressed his flock. A familiar face, once welcome at their table, addressed the congregation. Pray for Dr. Luxhold. Pray he sees the light before consigning himself to eternal damnation. Lord, he knows not your glory. I pray thee guide him to your heavenly kingdom. Oh, look, Judas made it after all, Nick joked. Talk about preaching to the choir. As he gestured, the hologram disappeared. I find it touching, Charles countered. A lot less brimstone than I might have expected from him. For a group so prone to violence, I see restraint. Jeb kept it in check for once. No storm the gates, just prayers. There's nothing touching about it, Charles. These are violent bullies we're dealing with, Nick countered. Have you ever bullied them? Charles asked. No, I fought for them. They're the ones who have no chance of immortality. Their lives are trivial. They will only be remembered for the pain they caused others. What if they are right? Eve asked. Eve, I know John found you and brought you here. I can appreciate that with your upbringing there will always be a tinge of the agnostic, no matter how clear the truth is. But the new Amish are not right about anything. Well said, Nick, Charles teased. You've really got a way of winning over the religious. Just ply them with your facts. That works. Nick's wife, Bianca, offered Charles a wry smile. She had spent their entire marriage watching similar discussions degrade. Charles, you know full well that if Nick had been on the deck of the Titanic, he would have spent his last moments confronting every single person who made the sign of the cross. He'd want them to know they were wasting their time. The whole table seemed to acknowledge the accuracy of Bianca's assertion before the six fell silent in reflection. After a few moments, Eve broke the silence. She looked over Charles's outfit. The tunic suits you. I'm glad you're wearing it. That outfit is special. Charles extended his arms, inviting further inspection. I look like a groom at an Indian wedding. Yes, that's kind of what I was going for. Nick told me you had a thing for Cynthia. Now you two will be together. Eve blushed. Had she overstepped? Eve worked to find her place among the colony elite. John had overseen her integration, but Babylon's customs and values remained alien. After her quarantine, John told Nick that he had finally found the perfect assistant for Charles. Trying to dispel the awkwardness, Charles conceded, "She is and was a 10. Who didn't have a crush on her?" He quickly interjected with a chuckle. "Except you, Nick, obviously. Spent half my life with potential suitors befriending me just to get to her. When they got there, she ate them alive. Never settled down." Eve turned to Nick, probing. "So you won't join them in the Elysium? No regret?" "Regrets? Unclear. Join them? No, it's too late. I'm too old. Besides, one of us has to stay behind and keep the lights on." Eve pushed a little harder. "But you will end. Your life will end. You don't believe you will go on, do you?" She didn't know Nick very well, but she needed to know why he had forgone immortalization. "Eve, my dear, there are many forms of immortality. I have attained several. First, as long as my brother, sister, and best friend exist on the plane of Elysium, I remain immortal, remembered. Second, there is my legacy here. I am the Saint Peter of immortality. I gave of myself so that others might have eternal life." With a twinkle in his eye and a sidelong glance at Eve, he said, "That's a pretty cool one, too." Nick turned to his wife and added, "Last and most important, I have children and a beautiful, loving wife. My children are my immortality. Venal, in a way, but it's what everyone else gets. I'm okay with a natural end."
"Saint Nick," Charles teased. "Somehow you just made my choice feel small."
"I understand the beauty of your choice, Dr. Santos," Eve remarked before adding. "Thank you for sharing. I hadn't fully considered it from those perspectives. You have a beautiful family."
Charles stood and with a feigned air of gravitas addressed the group.
"I think it's time for us to get going."
An impish grin crept up the sides of his mouth until he couldn't contain it.
"After all, I wouldn't want to be late to my own funeral."